and holding government officials accountable for their actions. Taking Action is produced by Empower DC. Listen every Tuesday on 89.3 FM at 1 p.m. Also available on iTunes Podcast and Google Play Music. On your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Good morning, Washington, D.C. This is Andy Shalal, and this is Works in Progress. We are definitely a work in progress, and we are coming to you now live. I am from my home, and we're trying to do the social distancing thing and trying to do the right thing and making sure that everybody stays healthy and well. And how are you? How are you out there? How are you feeling? I know this is a really tough time for all of us. And the one silver lining is here is that we're in this together, and it's a very different time. I think there's going to be a huge paradigm shift that's going to come out of this. Hopefully some good will come out of it, where we can work together more as a community and recognize our connections to one another globally, locally, and otherwise. I want to invite our listeners to be able to have a conversation with us today at 202-588-0893. So please call us so we can have a conversation with you about what you're thinking of, what you're doing to pass the time, what kind of projects are you taking on. For me, I'm actually having a hard time focusing. So, the idea of writing your next novel or writing a book or reading or organizing your closets or whatever you do sounds like a great idea. But when you're kind of paralyzed with anxiety and uncertainty, it makes it that much harder to be able to do anything that you like to do. But having said that, try to refocus, trying to stay sort of connected to a bigger picture. We have with us today, actually, we're going to be talking about prisons and, of course, the impact of the coronavirus on a lot of prisons. We've been reading a lot about that. We have Emily Gunston. She is Deputy Legal Director, Washington Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Urban Affairs. And she'll be with us in just a moment. We'll be talking with her about what's happening from the prison perspective. Of course, a population that's highly, vulnerable to this kind of thing, because just by very nature, prisons aren't designed to do social distancing per se. People have to interact with one another in very close quarters, making it that much harder. There's been a lot of writing about prisons and prison situations, and we want to be able to continue to monitor this and make sure that every one of our citizens, no matter who they are or where they are well taken care of. So I want to bring on Emily. Are you there, Emily? Hello, Emily. Are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Good morning. Hear you. Thank you. Good morning. We're kind of practicing this technology thing. And do you still hear me now?
I can, yes.
Okay, great. I have to leave my speaker on in order for me to be able to speak. And I have some alerts coming in. So I apologize if there's dings and bangs and all this while we're talking. So my apology ahead of time. But I wanted to first of all to thank you, and I guess the Washington Lawyers Guild, everybody's working from Lawyers Committee, everybody's working from home. Is that the idea?
That's exactly right. We're all working from home.
Yep. Have you had to have any layoffs, or are you guys busier than ever now?
No, we are busier than ever. I mean, of course, it's always a concern. We're a nonprofit organization, and we rely on donations and funding for our funding. So of course, with the downturn in the stock market, we're very concerned, but we are busier than ever, and there's a lot of really important work to be done, and is ongoing, in as we've talked about this morning, in particular right now, on behalf of people who are incarcerated.
Is your main focus local, or is it national?
The Washington Lawyers Committee focuses locally on behalf of Washington, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia and the local area. And we also do, by the way, a lot of work on behalf of workers' rights and housing justice, and all of those areas are being severely impacted by this current crisis and the financial impact it's having on everyone.
Yeah. So, is your focus, you particularly, is your focus now on prisons and prisoners right now as it relates to the coronavirus?
Yeah. Yeah. My focus in particular is in the criminal legal system. And so right now the COVID is having an impact on, we're doing a lot of work around, trying to keep people out of custody, trying to get people, keeping people from getting, taken into custody by the police and being kept in custody, by the courts and by BOP and, the local Department of Corrections, to try to protect everybody's health.
And how many people are we talking about? How many people are, I think for most people, they probably don't know this. How many people are in jail in D.C.?
So in the local jail, I think the population fluctuates daily. I think we're somewhere between 1,200 and 1,500 right now. I'm sorry, I don't have those exact numbers, but well over 1,000 people in the local jail.
And that does not include, of course, federal prisoners.
That's exactly right. The federal prisoners, as you know, they're D.C. They're not federal prisoners. They're D.C. prisoners, but they're housed in federal prisons all over the country.
All over the country. Got it. So is your main concern about the 1,200 to 1,500 people right now that are here in D.C. jails?
Our concern is all of them, right? But there are people in the D.C. jail who are incarcerated for a number of different reasons. Some of them are housed by the federal officials because they are in custody based on a technical violation of their parole. There are some people there being held by the local Department of Corrections because they are there pretrial. There are people in federal custody in the local halfway houses. And then, of course, there's D.C. prisoners in federal prisons all over the country. And we're concerned about the health of all of them.
And of course, the most obvious thing is to keep people out of jail. That's the most obvious sort of solution to some of these things. A lot of people are in for very minor violations or nonviolent offenses and really shouldn't be housed in a jail anyway. Is that your first and foremost frontline focus, is to keep people out and then try to sort of thin down the population of the people in there?
Yeah. That's right. I mean, I think the thing that's important to understand is that the social distancing measures that the CDC and the World Health Organization are telling us all to take are measures that prisoners are unable to take. They're measures that are just inconsistent with congregate settings, right? And so for people who are incarcerated, for people who are living in a halfway house and they're sharing bathrooms and hallways and sleeping in bunks with four and five people in a room and eating in congregate settings, in jails when people are being transported from one place to another, when people are being brought into court in handcuffs, they're interacting with other prisoners, they're interacting with law enforcement, they're interacting with staff, they're interacting with each other. And while there are important infection control steps that should be taken in carceral settings, the reality of it is it will not be possible to prevent the spread of this disease in a prison or a jail.
Got it. So how much success do you have in this regard of keeping people out or releasing early release for folks that shouldn't, that either are at the end of their sentence or shouldn't have been there to begin with? Are you getting a lot of cooperation from local officials on this?
So that remains to be seen. A lot of steps have been taken. A lot of really important steps have been taken. So, for example, the Metropolitan Police Department issued an executive order that reduces the number of folks that police officers are required to conduct a custodial arrest for. So more people should be getting citations. Of course, that needs to be implemented on the street. We're trying to monitor it to make sure that officers actually are using their discretion to not take people into custody. Similarly, we've gotten reports that the U.S. Parole Commission has committed to us that they're no longer going to be arresting people on technical violations except in certain circumstances, that people will not be housed in custody for technical violations of their parole. Again, we hope that actually is implemented in an effective way. There are additional steps that need to be taken. The City Council took a really important step of providing to the Department of Corrections discretion to give more people who are serving sentences in the jail good time credits, to increase the amount of good time credits they can get so that they can finish their sentence sooner. As of today, that discretion has not been effectively implemented. And so there are people still in the jail who have, you know, 60 days left on their sentence, 45 days left on their sentence. They're serving misdemeanor sentences. Those people absolutely should not be in custody. And we're advocating that folks, city officials, use their discretion to let folks like that out for the safety of the people who are in the jail and for the rest of us and for the staff in the jail.
Absolutely. That makes perfect sense. What are the statistics now as far as the presence of COVID-19, the virus that causes the or the coronavirus that causes the illness? What are the numbers that you're hearing about? All prisoners being tested? How do we know and all of that?
No, we don't know how many prisoners are being tested. Certainly not all of them. What we know is that 5 people in the district's jails have tested positive. And we know that 6 prisoners and 4 prison staffers in the BOP system have tested positive. 1 federal prisoner has died of the virus. But we also know that testing is not widespread. And I think recommendations from and information from health officials would let us know that if there are this many confirmed cases, we know that there are many, many more.
Now, my understanding, and I don't know if this has changed, my understanding that a lot of prisons require a copayment from prisoners to even see the nurse or the doctor at the prison. Is that correct?
It's true that a lot of prisons do. I'm sorry, you know, I don't know the latest information about whether or not the Bureau of Prisons or the local jail is charging prisoners a copay. But obviously that's a practice that is inconsistent with infection control. I'd also note that putting people in isolation when they report symptoms or putting people in solitary confinement when they report symptoms, rather, is also concerning about whether or not folks will be reluctant to report symptoms.
I see. So solitary confinement is used as a way to quarantine people. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. That's right. And more we know that more and more of the federal facilities are going on lockdown, which means prisoners are not allowed out of their cells. They've already, in most prisons and jails around the country, or I should say in many prisons and jails around the country, including our local jail, they've cut off visitation, which is appropriate to reduce the chance of the virus coming into the facility. But of course, you can imagine the extent to which that really increases the isolation that people who are incarcerated feel.
Well, yeah, it sort of makes no sense. I mean, if you're sick, you need to be in a hospital or somewhere where you're taken care of. Solitary confinement doesn't sound like a good place for someone who's ill.
That's right. That's right. And the other thing is, as you can imagine, prisons and jails are the medical care in a prison or a jail already is stretched thin. The medical care is not the same as one would receive outside of a prison or a jail in the best of circumstances, and they're just not equipped to deal with a pandemic like this. The system will be quickly overwhelmed if prisoners start turning up sick in large numbers, which they almost certainly will.
I mean, this whole thing is really testing the morality of our society and what matters and what doesn't matter in the hierarchy of people that are given care as opposed to those who are left to die or fend for themselves. It's quite disturbing, really, to see this kind of situation that has been created that sort of has highlighted so much shortcomings in the way we do healthcare and the way we allocate resources and all of that. It's really quite frightening, frankly, to see it, because even you're seeing it in New York and you're seeing it in Italy and in Europe and many countries where they have to make choices of who they can save. And it sounds to me like in this situation, prisoners sit at the very bottom of that ladder.
That's exactly right. And the prisoners know that, right? So try to put yourselves in the position of these folks who are incarcerated and how scared they must feel. They know the virus is coming. They know that once it gets into the facility that they're in, there's no air circulation. They're unable to wash their hands regularly. They don't have access to hand sanitizers. They know that the virus is coming. They know that it will spread rapidly through the facility that they're in. Many of them, the pre-existing conditions that put you at risk for death and serious harm from this virus, prisoners have those underlying conditions disproportionately represented among the prisoner population than in the outside population. They know they are at risk of this virus. They know that it's coming. And they also know that no one will help them when it does, right? They are fearful that they are going to be left to die.
Wow. That's really frightening. You know, it's hard enough being on the outside and having to, you know, self-isolate and do these kind of situations. It's another when you don't have any control over your life at all and you're put in a situation like that where there's this imminent existential threat that's happening around you and you have no control over anything and how to deal with it. And that's really,
that's
really
exactly
frightening.
Right.
Are you seeing any states or cities or jurisdictions who are doing a remarkable job in this area of how to deal with these types of situations?
You know, a remarkable job might be strong. We are seeing that jurisdictions around the country are taking measures to let people out of custody. You've probably seen that in some of the Bay Area counties, Alameda County, Sacramento, San Francisco, prosecutors are being told not to oppose release for pretrial detainees as long as there's no public safety concern. In Alameda County, hundreds of inmates were let out of the jail based on sentence modification and early release. There are some prison systems. In Illinois, the governor signed an executive order that eased the restrictions on early prison releases for good behavior. Measures like that have been taken. You know, Attorney General Barr did issue a memo in which he acknowledged that there are people in prison who don't need to be there and that are at risk. And he urged BOP to use its discretion to release people on home confinement where possible. Now, there's a lot of problems with the way they make those determinations. And I think most advocates are skeptical about whether or not this actually is going to result in the release of anyone or certainly anyone in large numbers. But I think, as to your point earlier, I think it's an important acknowledgement about the ease at which we are willing to keep people in cages for very long periods of time, even long after anyone really thinks that they are a danger to the community or could safely live in their communities.
We are listening to, this is WPFW, of course, we're listening to Emily Gunston. She is Deputy Legal Director for the Washington Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Urban Affairs. And we're talking about prisoners and the impact of the COVID-19 on prisons and prisoners and prison populations. I wanted to ask you, what can people do to advocate? I know that, you know, we've had a for a long time, I think, you know, returning citizens were kind of forgotten. A lot of people just assume that they're just, you know, they deserve what they're getting and they should be left to do whatever they have. And, you know, what was happening is people were being released with no real direction of where to go and what to do and so on. What can people do to be sort of better advocates for people that are incarcerated and people, especially those that have done their time and are out in the community now? Because that's really, I think, the challenge that we face. Even people that may be released now, of course, you know, if you're saying that a lot of people are going to be released in the next few weeks because of the situation, what happens to them when they come out? What happens to folks like that?
So those are really important questions. It certainly is true that the services for folks who are returning home are not adequate, and I want to touch on that a little bit more. The first point I wanted to make, though, is one of the narratives I hear quite a bit when this topic comes up is that folks are saying that people might be safer in a prison or a jail since they have access to medical care there and they'll have nowhere to go when they come out. That simply is not true, and I want folks to be disabused of that notion. People are in grave danger when they're housed in a congregate setting, and many of these folks do have places to go, and they are not safe in a prison or a jail, and they don't have access to adequate medical care. Once they are released, it is important that we provide services, particularly folks who are coming home from federal prisons, who have been gone in some cases for decades. They're coming home to a city that they no longer recognize. Their families may be gone. They've been priced out of the city. And they no longer have the communities that can support them that they had when they went in. They don't have access to paperwork to allow them to get an identification card or their social security card so they can get benefits, right? We should be doing a better job of making sure that people have housing. The city should be creating voucher programs for people who are coming home to make sure that people have a place to live, particularly in this during this pandemic. It is for the protection of all of us, and it is basic human rights. The other thing that I would point out is that as long as we don't have control in the District of Columbia of our criminal legal system, our prisoners are prosecuted by federal agencies, and they are housed by federal agencies. And that exacerbates all of these issues because people are housed very far from home, and there's not good communication between the District of Columbia and the Federal Bureau of Prisons. The federal authorities do not provide the city with enough information about who's coming home and when they are coming home so that the city can take measures to try to assist those people.
Now, I know that we have an Office of Returning Citizens. I know, a few years ago when I was doing some research on this, it was woefully underfunded and understaffed and really didn't have the resources to be able to be as impactful. I know that there's, about 6,000 or so returning citizens that we have amongst us, or is this, I can't remember, but how many returning citizens are there in the District of Columbia today?
You know, that's a good question. I don't have those numbers at my disposal. The number that you've listed sounds about right to me. I'm sorry that I don't have it. And you're right that the Mayor's Office of Returning Citizens continues to be underfunded and understaffed.
So that office, I know that had a couple $100,000 in their budget, and their role, I suspect, was to make sure that they help prisoners or people that have been released, returning citizens, to be able to find jobs, get housing, get their Social Security card, get a driver's license, whatever they need to get in order for them to be able to be a productive member of society. And yet there are so many barriers to allow people to be their full self. Has that changed at all? Has that improved in the last couple of years when I was looking into this?
So I don't know the current numbers of the budget. It is still true that they continue to be understaffed and underfunded. What we hear from folks when they go to that office to try to get services is that it's only open certain hours. They have to wait a really long time to get any services, and the services that they do get are, despite the best efforts of the folks who work there, that the services they receive are not sufficient.
Which really kind of is makes you wonder, what purpose does that serve? Because, once people are out, you don't want them to go back in. I mean, maybe you do. Maybe that's the intent, But the idea is to keep people out of prison so that they can become a productive member of society, pay their taxes, do their job, work, whatever it is. So to have a office that is charged with taking care of those issues and have it be underfunded, seems like you're shooting yourself in the foot. Why do you suspect that there has not been enough effort and resources to be put in that arena, being that it helps everybody? It's such an obvious win-win-win for everyone. Why haven't we funded more?
I don't know the answer to that. I suspect it is related to the fact that folks who have been incarcerated are just an underserved population of people. I think they are among the most vulnerable among us, and they are discarded. I think that people have this sense that they've done something wrong, and they just are not concerned about them in the same way. And I think people just don't understand the lengths of the sentences that people are serving, and the obstacles they face to reentry when they come home, and how they are just set up for failure. They come home and they don't necessarily have a place to live. It's almost impossible for them to find employment that would allow them to continue to live in the District of Columbia because of discrimination against them. and the housing prices in the city. They have onerous reporting requirements. They have all kinds of technical rules that they need to follow that's difficult under the best of circumstances, let alone the circumstances that they find themselves in. Sometimes they left when they were young men, and they're now returning home, and they are middle-aged or older. And so the idea that they could just navigate this and get them and pull themselves up by their bootstraps is just ludicrous.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And is it true that you cannot have Section 8 housing if you have been to prison?
You know, I'm sorry. I think that that's right. And I don't know the current status of that. I think that that is right.
Yeah. Which means that if they have a family member who is willing to take them in and they live in public housing somehow, that they would then lose their benefits if they were to
that's
take that
right.
person
they
in.
Can lose so their, they lose the their, that's right. If they have somebody living with them who has a felony conviction, they can lose their voucher.
Exactly. And that in itself seems really, really onerous and just, you know, just a stupid rule, you know, that doesn't make any sense.
That's right.
Yeah. What can people do to be better advocates for those among us who are, returning citizens or have been incarcerated? What can we do?
Well, you know, we should put pressure on city officials to do what they can do within their authority.
Can you be more specific when you say city officials?
Yes.
Can you be
the mayor?
Who is in charge? Okay, the
Quincy
mayor?
Booth. Uh-huh. Quincy Booth is in charge of the Department of Corrections. Quincy Booth and his department should be using his discretion to give more people good time and let them out of custody. The mayor should be working with local officials to figure out exactly who can safely be released. There should be pressure brought to bear on federal officials, including the U.S. attorney, to let people out of custody, to not oppose their release from custody pretrial. For people who are nearing the end of their sentences in the halfway house, almost everyone in the halfway house, if not everybody, should be let out of the halfway house. Those are folks who, by definition, the purpose of a halfway house, right, is transitional services. And so those people, up until several days ago, were going into the community to have to work, to find jobs, to go to trainings. They're on lockdown now. But those are folks who already were out in the community and should be out in the community. They're either nearing their sentences or their pretrial, and they're being housed in a way that is a danger to them and our community, and they should all be let out.
Right. I mean, that's the thing about this coronavirus. It's kind of equalizing, in its own way, equalizing the ground in a sense, you know, because if
that's
somebody
right.
around you isn't well, chances are you might be the recipient of those viruses and become sick. So I think that's an interesting shift that we are seeing now.
That's
we
right.
We're all
and
in
I
this
think
together,
also,
literally.
That's exactly right. And I think it's also important to note, in terms of advocacy and pressure that can be brought to bear, the D.C. should have control over its criminal legal system. The fact that folks who are coming home who are on parole have to report to a federal parole board as opposed to a local agency, and that there's a federal agency that's deciding who goes back into custody, we will never be able to make the decisions that are consistent with the values of the voters of the District of Columbia until we have control over our criminal legal system. And so even once this pandemic is over, folks need to mobilize and put pressure on the city to ensure that it takes back control of the criminal legal system from the federal government.
Another call for statehood. Yeah, absolutely. Very, very good. Well, I appreciate you being on, Emily. Thank you so much. What are you doing to pass the time? I mean, obviously you're busy.
I'm working really hard. You know, I have a kid who's home from school, and so that makes it difficult. But, you know, this is a really important time. There's so much advocacy and work that needs to be done. So at the Washington Lawyers Committee, we're all working really long hours, longer even than normal, to try to do what we can to protect people from this virus and from the financial implications of this virus.
Well, thank you so much, Emily Gunston. She is Deputy Legal Director, Washington Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Urban Affairs. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And thank you so much for being on the front line of this very, very important issue.
Thank you for covering this story.
Absolutely. Now we want to go to some callers. I don't know, do we have the social justice calendar today? I just want to make sure that if we need to take a break or should we just continue?
Yes, we should go ahead and take a break, Andy.
All right, so before we take a break, that's Michael Nasella, who is the engineer. Thank you so much for being there. We are socially distancing ourselves, but I wanted to just remind callers, 202-588-0893. Is the number for you to call in if you want to be part of a conversation that we want to continue having, talk about what's happening in your world, what's happening in the world around us, and what are you doing with this coronavirus situation? Are you staying at home? Do you have to work? What are you doing when you're home? Do you have children? All these conversations, I think we all need to be connected to one another and learn from one another and to be able to get through this together. So when we come back, I'll be expecting your calls at 202-588-0893. Stay tuned for the Social Justice Calendar. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Joseph Green. During this period of the coronavirus pandemic, WPFW is putting our Social Justice Calendar on hold, or actually repurposing it to assist those stepping forward to lessen the severity of this crisis. We're inviting submissions to the WPFW Social Justice COVID-19 Resource Bulletin. Please email brief blurbs to be included in this weekly listing of webinars, services, and/or supplies being provided to address this crisis. All ways people can get involved. Submissions for the Social Justice COVID-19 Resource Bulletin should be a short script that includes, in this order, 1. A sentence describing the type of aid, service, webinar, etc. 2. The times this is open or available, if applicable. 3. The location where it is being offered or how it is delivered or accessed. And lastly, a phone number with an email or website for more information. Submissions should be sent with no attachment to Social Justice WPFW at ips-dc.org. That's Social Justice WPFW at ips-dc.org. The Social Justice COVID-19 Resource Bulletin is a public service brought to you by the Institute for Policy Studies in partnership with WPFW, your station for jazz and justice.
We are back. This is WPFW. I'm Andy Shalal. This is Works in Progress. And I wanted to just continue the conversation about what's going on. I I know that a lot of you have been going through a lot of anxiety and a lot of uncertainty about in this situation. We have had to lay off quite a bit of people, and sadly so. It's really, really hard to do, and we've tried to keep as many people as possible on our payroll. We're hoping that the federal assistance and other assistance is coming our way, and we are sure that that will help in many ways. And we're still trying to figure out ways that we can help our staff and others who have been affected by this situation. And we have tried to keep as many people as possible, like I mentioned, on our staff, and continue to pay them. In the meantime, I think walking around in the city, you know, we deal with a lot of artists and a lot of musicians and people who don't have really even any way to verify their income, in a sense, because they work hand to mouth, and it's very hard for them to even have any kind of forms to file taxes and prove that they've made this much money and so on. So they may be completely left out. So we wanted to do something kind of interesting. I had a phone call from a reporter the other day who asked me if we were going to be boarding up our windows. And I said, for what? And he said, well, a lot of restaurants and businesses are starting to board up their windows. And I guess in anticipation of possible looting and other problems that may happen should this go on much longer. And my answer was absolutely not. That's not how we operate. That's not what we do. And I of course, said that we wouldn't do that. Not only we wouldn't do that, but we decided to actually hire artists, pay them, to be able to come and do some artwork on our window storefronts. And so we are working with artists and others to be able to do work on our window storefronts, providing some inspirational and positive and joyful messages for the people walking around. I noticed, you know, like many of you, I'm sure, that are walking around the city, there's a sense of foreboding, fear, and the sense of isolation, a little bit of darkness that feels a little bit overwhelming sometimes. And I think looking around and seeing the all these boarded up storefronts doesn't help. And wouldn't it be great if we were to walk around and not only see boarded up, if we see boarded up storefronts, have them be full of positive, you know, inspirational, uplifting messages done by artists. So that's what our hope is. So we're going to start that tomorrow, trying to get as many people as possible to be involved and trying to raise funds as much as possible to make sure that we pay all the artists who are going to be involved in this. Many of our staff are artists. Many of our people that we work with are artists, and we want to be able to have them at least earn some income during this very, very difficult time. So that's going to be happening, and we're trying to get as many businesses in the city to join us in this process so that we can have a city that has joyful messages all around it to be able to keep people kind of focused and uplifted and having a sense of hope and inspiration moving forward. So I would like to be able to take a couple calls. I don't know if we have any callers. Do we have any callers, Michael?
Yes.
Can we take a caller? Hello, caller, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. This is Lisa.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing good. I was confused a bit because you were talking about and I thought you laid off people at WPFW, and then I thought they were volunteers, and then I realized
I apologize. No. Yep. No, I'm talking about Busboys and Poets. We've had to lay off a lot of people, unfortunately.
Okay.
And we're trying to figure out a way to raise funds and try to figure out a way that we can continue to stay solvent so we can reopen. As you can imagine, especially in the restaurant business, the cash flow is really, really important. And you pay, you know, yesterday's bills with today's revenue. And when today's revenue shuts off, the avalanche of payables comes at you fast and furious. So we want to make sure we can be able to reopen in order to continue to function. So
I have a question for you.
Clear.
I have a question for you. So the president said that the federal aid was for businesses who didn't lay off their staff. So how are you going to get that if you've already laid off your staff?
Well, the problem with that is that you have to pay ahead of time in order for you to be able to stay, and that legislation is not that clear. So we really have no idea of what to do at this point. I have somebody that's working on that to see if it makes sense for us to do that and whether or not this is absolutely true. You know, as you know, the president says things sometimes that don't come to fruition. And we want to make sure that we are in a situation where we don't, you know, stick our neck too far, because then we will be unable to reopen. I mean,
That was my concern. You'd be jammed because, okay, so in order for you to get the grant that you don't have to pay back, you have to hire the people back. But how long will that, in order to get the federal funds or the federal assistance, how long will that take? And then if you do that, then you're preventing them from applying for unemployment. So it's a weird place to be. Like, which one is it?
We felt the unemployment route is probably the best route, especially with the checks that are coming in from the federal government, the $1,200 per person plus $500 per child, plus the unemployment that they get from D.C., plus an additional $600 that may be available for folks for unemployment may be able to stem the need for folks to be able to stay, you know, with some income. We're also providing all of our staff free meal a day so that they can come out and pick up their food anytime during the time that we are open for carry out. So that's also available for folks.
That's awesome.
We're really trying to do as best as we can, understanding that, you know, people are always going to expect us to do more, obviously. But the situation we find ourselves in is that as we were told, we were supposed to stay. This was going to continue probably till around the 24th of April. And now we understand it's going to go through the end of April, which means we're talking about May and possibly even the end of May at this point. So like Dr. Fauci said, he said, you know, we can't set a timeline. The virus is going to set the timeline for us. So we have no idea. And that thing, that's what makes it really, really difficult.
The other thing, and I think that we should all be thinking this way. I work with military researchers. That's what I do. So I'm actually really busy working from home. But I think that we're going to have to think about what's next. Because even when you open, how are you going to get people back? I mean, it's just, so things are going to change.
Exactly.
It's going to be different. We can't go back to the, you know, so-called normal. It's going to be different. And I think we all need to prepare for that in whatever way that is.
That's a very important point, because we don't know whether when we open, people are going to come back in droves. They're going to come back in trickles. We don't know. We have no idea. And it's going to be very, very difficult to make that judgment. We may, you know, I mean, I think I'm talking to other restaurant folks, and many of them are saying, you know what, I'm going to call it a day. This is not going to work for me. Either they're declaring bankruptcy or they're just closing the doors and just I mean, that's going to be a reality. We're going to have, I would, you know, I've heard anywhere estimates from 30 to 50% of restaurants will not be able to come back.
That's a very serious
you know, statement, obviously. And I think because restaurants, you know, the thing about this situation that's happened, I think for people that are listening to understand the impact on restaurants. Restaurants, unlike other things, we can't work from home. Okay. So there's only one way you do the work, and that is to be there. So that's one. The other part is that for many restaurants, the winter months tend to be much quieter and much less busy. And so you gear up for the spring. Spring is our best months of the year. And we end up hiring a lot more people, getting ready for patio season, and doing whatever it takes to make sure that we are shored up so that when spring opens or starts, we go full force. And for us, spring starts the 1st of March. That's when the spring season begins. Of course, this hit exactly at that moment. So I know there's not a good time for a pandemic, but if there was ever a worse time.
This is the worst time
because it's going to cause a huge impact, because already people were running on very, very thin margins. People need to understand that restaurants have sometimes 2%, 3%, 4% profit margin, which is very, very thin and can go out just like that. You know, our payroll every single 2 weeks is like well over $750,000. So you're talking like, we don't make that kind of money every month. So just losing that immediately, just like that, makes it really impossible for us to continue to be solvent if we were to keep everybody on board.
Yeah. And then the other thing I saw was the food distributors to the restaurant. They're hurt because they can't pivot to deliver to to supermarkets. That's not how they not how they deliver food. So they it's such a trickle down effect the way around. I'm praying that things get better soon. Thank you.
Yep. Well, thank you so much for your call. Appreciate you. Thank you. Michael, do we have other callers?
Yes, we have one more caller.
Hello, are you there, caller?
How are you doing? Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Hey, I just wanted to kind of say that I heard you say that people are walking around in fear and that there was this foreboding sense. I go out every day. I live in Ward 1 in Northwest, and I go out every day, and I don't sense and I don't see this foreboding, this general sense of fear out there. In fact, I don't live in fear, and I think I hear in your voice the stress of your particular situation, but I think from what I see when I go out in the streets and just do things, the people, at least the ones I see out in the street, they're not acting like they're in fear. I think a lot of people, I think most people are taking this as it is, and dealing with it, because people are out running, they're doing stuff, they're playing basketball, they're doing a lot of normal things. And I think people in positions don't give people enough credit. They treat people as they're overly stupid and think that they don't have enough sense to do what's in their right interest. There are, of course, going to be people who will do stupid things, but I don't think that's the majority of them. And I've gone down 14th Street, and I do see some businesses have boarded up their storefronts. And I lived in the city in 1968, and I know real fear. I lived in the city when they had the National Guard going up and down 14th and U, and things were burning. You know, I was a child then, but I still remember it. I remember them shutting down my all the schools, and there was a contingent of National Guard sitting in my junior high school. And I rode my bike up to the school, and on a jeep of white National Guards came up with a machine gun pointing in our face and said, "Go home." So I lived in that time, and that was fear. This isn't fear. This is a time of reckoning. And like this, and people have not gotten the memo yet. People think that they can go back to what they were doing, that this whole country, in fact, that this whole Western world can go back to what they were doing before this came. There ain't going to be no going back. There's going to be a whole paradigm shift that's going to happen. And either people are going to be able to make the shift in a stable and conscious way, or there's going to be a big die-off. And there's probably going to be a big die-off because the majority of the people in the majority of systems and the majority of people who have it good now don't want to give up the system that made them have it good now. But that system is long gone now. It won't be able to come back. And people have got to get their minds straight and say, look, whatever got me to the place that I was before ain't going to be what's going to get me to the place after. And that's where the stress of many people, I think, are realizing that the life they had ain't going to be the life they're going to have going forward. But those who can deal with that in a positive way, those who can deal with that in a way of inspiration, in a way that they can become, you know, they can show some ingenuity, those are the people who are going to be able to make a better world. because actually there are a lot of benefits coming out of this thing. They talk about all the pollution that has decreased, and they talked about all the cities where the pollution and the air quality is getting better, and they say the air quality getting better is actually an aid to people because this is a respiratory disease, and that people's the air in all these cities are getting better, which is actually helping the majority of the people in the cities because they say 400,000 people a year die in the United States of air pollution related illnesses or maladies. So there are a lot of benefits that are going to come out of this. Obesity and diabetes is going to decrease because people aren't eating all this junk food. Thank goodness when you go through the grocery stores, you see the potato chips and all the cookies and stuff on the shelf.
I don't know about the junk food part. But when you're sitting around the house all day long, those potato chips look really good, you know? So I'm not sure about that part.
People shouldn't sit around the house every day. People should stop acting like this is a death sentence. People should create some sense of normalcy. You can go outside. You can do things. People are walking their dogs. People are running. At least in Northwest they are. You should stop thinking of this, and you should stop promoting it as a death sentence. People have got to say this is a chance for a reboot. This is a chance for humanity because we're going to be off the planet, but the squirrels are not. I don't see the squirrels having a problem. I don't see the pigeons having a problem. I don't see any other life form having a problem other than humans.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Well, thank you so much, caller. Appreciate you. Thank you for your comments. Hello, Michael. Do we have any other callers?
Yes, we have one more caller, Andy.
Okay, let's take the last caller. Hello, caller, are you there?
I'm here. I am here.
Hello, what's on your mind?
I live in a wonderful neighborhood where we are trying to follow all the guidelines to be safe, and we are also coming up with ideas that we can do so we can know each other better, communicate better, so that when we come out of this, we are in a different place as far as our connections. And we have a couple of connections going on, and I'd like to find out ideas from other people.
But what kind of connections are you doing?
Well, this morning a neighbor told me she gets a poem every day, and I told her I had a poem. So I said, I have the emails of everyone on the street. Let's send our poems out to everyone. So that's a simple one. On Wednesday, we have some experts in bird habitat coming to stand far apart from us in our neighborhood and explaining to us what we can do in our gardens to encourage the birds to come and stay. We don't know that stuff. And I'm looking for other ideas.
Oh, wonderful. Well, our neighborhood started a listserv, and they started doing some activities. And one of the most successful one has been they do this Friday night happy hour on the stoop. So everybody comes out, sits in front of their home. They may have a glass of wine or a cup of tea or whatever they drink and sit there and enjoy it while they're talking to their neighbors from a distance, and people have gotten to know each other in a very interesting way.
I'm going to ask people if they want to try that. Thank you.
Yeah, so that's a really great one. The other one was that I'm trying to encourage people to do. As I mentioned earlier, we are doing asking different businesses, all the businesses that have been boarded up or been closed because of the coronavirus and the social distancing that's taking place, to paint inspirational messages on their storefronts and joyful messages for people when they're walking around. They can look at something positive and something uplifting rather than just seeing closed stores. So that's one thing. What I wanted to also suggest is we have worked before with an organization called Chalk for Peace. Chalk, like the writing chalk, and they do the sidewalk effort where they put, you know, chalk messages for peace in the world or whatever. And wouldn't it be nice for neighborhoods, especially kids, to come out with these big chalk markers that they can use on the sidewalk to be able to draw some ideas and inspirational things and make some statements so that when people are walking down the street, they're able to read and get connected to the folks that are inside the homes. And I think that's one way to also connect communities with one another. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I know adults that even do fancy chalk work on sidewalks, so we could do that too. Thank you for these
great
ideas.
Yeah, so these are some ideas that we're trying to promote in this city. I think this is, like so many of you have said, this is an opportunity for all of us to sort of take a deliberate pause and really kind of think in terms of our connections to one another rather than what separates us. And because too often we do focus on that part. So that is just about it. Thank you so much, caller. I appreciate you. I appreciate all the callers and our earlier guest. We talked about prisons with Emily Gunston. She is Deputy Legal Director, Washington Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Urban Affairs. We urge you to connect with them as well to help in the line of prisoners and what they're doing in this coronavirus times. And I appreciate all of you listeners, WPFW. Thank you, Mike Nocella. Thank you, Katia Stitt. Thank you, Sue Goodwin and Jerry Paris and all of you that make the station continue to be what it is. Until next time, I will see you. Stay safe, stay healthy, and I look forward to talking to you when we can connect with one another and give each other a real hug. Take care.
Hi, I'm Joseph Green. During this period of the coronavirus pandemic, WPFW is putting our social justice calendar on hold, or actually repurposing it to assist those stepping forward to lessen the severity of this crisis. We're inviting submissions to the WPFW Social Justice COVID-19 Resource Bulletin. Please email brief blurbs to be included in this weekly listing of webinars, services, and/or supplies being provided to address this crisis. All ways people can get involved. Submissions for the Social Justice COVID-19 Resource Bulletin should be a short script that includes, in this order, 1. A sentence describing the type of aid, service, webinar, etc. 2. The times this is open or available, if applicable. 3. The location where it is being offered or how it is delivered or accessed. And lastly, a phone number with an email or website for more information. Submissions should be sent with no attachment to Social Justice WPFW at ips-dc.org. That's Social Justice WPFW at ips-dc.org. The Social Justice COVID-19 Resource Bulletin is a public service brought to you by the Institute for Policy Studies in partnership with WPFW, your station for jazz and justice.
Greetings, I'm Jerry Paris, General Manager.
And I'm Katia Stitt, Interim Program Director.
COVID-19 knows no borders. Our own health is only as good as that of the person standing next to us. This is a profound reminder of our common humanity and connectedness, reinforcing the fact that human rights are truly global.
WPFW is responding to this crisis through a myriad of ways. Relevant, fact-based public affairs and news programming, mindful and resonant music programming, the creation of the Social Justice COVID-19 Resource Bulletin, listing resources for those in need, and the expansion of Union City Radio to include daily COVID-19's impact on workers.
In an effort to keep our staff and programmers safe, we are moving to remote broadcasting and working hard to ensure the highest quality sound for our listeners. We are in the process of upgrading our website, engaging heavily on social media, and introducing the ability to donate via Cash App, ensuring that we stay connected to the community.
Stay tuned to WPFW, Pacifica Radio in the nation's capital, for all things COVID-19. Always distilled through the lens of social justice.
WPFW 89.3 FM and streaming at WPFWFM.org.
Your station for jazz and justice.